Well, who could forget that iconic scene from the 1989 film Pet Sematary, based on the book by Stephen King, where one of the characters is tormented by her sister Zelda, who she was charged to take care of. It's a scene that has given plenty of people nightmares and is lodged in the imagination of so many of us as a sense of caretaking horror or a body horror, the horror of shame. Great, because right now I'm in the middle of a series of episodes covering my favorite genre, horror, with some of its greatest creators, this time John Langan and Sophie White. The series coincides with the paperback release of my novel, Hawk Mountain. There are few genres that have inspired such a furor of regulation, stigma, and anger as horror. It's regulated by governments. It's been the topic of moralistic examinations and moral panics. It's been blamed for disintegrating societies and more. Horror itself horrifies. And when horror does become accepted, it is at best said by its critics to transcend the genre, which really just means it's transcending the stigma that the critics have put there and that they're now removing their stigma for a second. But I don't want to talk about horrors being beleaguered. I've started this episode with that clip from a Stephen King movie. Stephen King is the most consistently best-selling author of all time, a horror writer. What does that mean? What does it mean that horror is at once stigmatized and critically ridiculed and regulated, but also an extremely popular way of making art? Across these episodes, I talk about horror in so many different ways. The previous episode of the series was episode 233, featuring writers Nathan Ballingrud and Sarah Grant. The first was on cosmic horror with writer and scholar Matt Carden. This series has been partially inspired by the 1990 Horror Cafe on BBC Two, featuring Clive Barker, John Carpenter, Roger Corman, Lisa Tuttle, Ramsey Campbell, and Peter Atkins, phew, in conversation with each other. I loved that conversation. It was sent to me by J.F. Martel, who co-hosts Weird Studies, and they just had such a good time talking about what scares people and how to come up with a scary story together. So each of these episodes, well, most of them at least, feature me in conversation with more than one horror writer talking about what scares us, what scares others, why horror is vital, and more. You don't have to know much about horror, even like horror, to follow along with these episodes, because horror locates itself in our lives in so many ways. It's inescapable. And that's what I talk about at length in this episode. Locating horror in our lives, in histories of violence, in histories of supernatural occurrences, in our bodies, which in some ways are the site of daily horror, and of course, in our loved ones, in their presence, absence, and our fear of both, including the fear of taking care of them while they're sick. To discuss all this and more, I asked two award-winning and prolific writers onto the show, John Langan and Sophie White. John Langan is perhaps best known for his Bram Stoker award-winning novel, The Fisherman, which is composed of horror stories within horror stories, as different characters deal with loss and a grotesque and supernatural presence in nearby waters. He's the author of numerous excellent short story collections, most recently Corpse Mouth and other autobiographies. Sophie White is the author of The Caretaking Nightmare, Where I End, which recently won the Shirley Jackson Award. She's also written a book of horror essays, Corpsing, My Body, and Other Horror Shows, which are both out from Tramp Press here in Ireland. So we talk about transplanted organ horror, horrific fairies, the horror of classical elements, the horror of history itself, the horror of not understanding how others grieve. I mean, there are so many directions to go in, and we go in all of them. Against Everyone with Connor Habib exists because people sign up on Patreon and pledge a certain amount every month, or just drop one big yearly pledge. It doesn't even have to be big. So if you go to patreon.com/ConorHabib, you can support the show, keep it going. If you like this discussion, if it makes you think of horrific things, if it freaks you out, if it makes you want to read things that you haven't read before, if it introduces you to new writers, new thoughts, new stories, please do give to the show by going to patreon.com/ConorHabib. Every episode of this show is free, and there's lots of them now. This is 234, including tons of older episodes with horror writers, Kelly Link, Brian Evanson, Ramsey Campbell, and more. So, patreon.com/ConorHabib. That's it. I don't have any sponsors. It's just supported by listeners like you. All right, here we go. Hello, everybody. It's Against Everyone with Connor Habib. Hello, John Langan and Sophie White. Hi.
Hello.
Hey.
All right. Well, you know, there's a lot of horror that's just very kind of in the moment. You know, maybe it has a little bit of backstory, but people are living their lives and something intrudes. Something shows up and disrupts things. But I think in both your cases, there's a real there's a real reference to a deep kind of history when you tell horror stories. So I wanted to start there, and I'll let whoever wants to start with that run with it, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I suppose I very often, it with a story, see a place first, you know, and wonder what's happened here, you know, and that can often be the beginnings for me of a story. And I do kind of feel like, you know, with kind of hauntings, I feel like they, like, I always imagine hauntings more as kind of like, you know, past experiences kind of being absorbed in the walls and kind of layer upon layer of, say, trauma and things like that sort of being superimposed inside, say, a building or like a landscape. And I, you know, and I think a lot about Ireland in those terms, because we have such a kind of like, we have like bedrock of trauma and violence in Ireland. And like, what country doesn't, really? Because it's always been, you know, country gets pillaged and colonized and, you know, erased. And, you know, the new dominator is now then imprinting on the landscape. I am very interested in place because I think that we all like kind of collectively live in the hangover of the past, and we're so formed by it. And I think in Ireland as well, like, so much of the trauma in Ireland is so within reach. It's like we can still touch it. Up until 2018, abortion was illegal, and Irish institutional bodies forced women to have, you know, forced pregnancy was essentially the order of the day. And even things like homosexuality was illegal in my lifetime, you know. So that kind of aspect of Irish life is very interesting. And I think there's like a real national haunting. And obviously, if you go further back, the famine is just this apocalypse. It doesn't take too far back for generations to somebody have a grandparent who remembers Black 47 was what they called the worst year of the famine, which I always think is very apocalyptic. So I've spoken a bit about place, and particularly with reference to the place I come from. So that's the place that made me.
My family is Scottish and Irish, and much more Irish than we realized, even. My mom did one of those 23andMe things. And my parents are both from Scotland, from the west of Scotland. And They were Scottish Catholics, which is a very particular and peculiar kind of thing. And there was a lot. And this was actually, to, in response to your question, Connor, this was not where I thought I was going to go with this, but I just want to follow up on what Sophie was saying, that it, my parents came over here, and one of the things that in the early 60s, and they were looking for religious freedom, I guess you would say. They were looking for economic opportunity, but they had it pretty decent in the west of Scotland, in Greenock and Gourock. But they were, my father, I think in particular, wanted some place where there wouldn't be Orange March and all that kind of stuff, the Battle of the Boyne celebrations and such. And yet, in a lot of ways, I saw him in particular sort of haunted by that experience, and that in that part of Scotland, in Glasgow, the sort of middle of the country, the big industrial city, you know, the two soccer teams, football teams, right, are the Celtic and the Rangers, and you can guess which one is associated with which religion. Uh-huh. And when they meet, it's a chance to have a riot. You know, I maybe it's a little better. I don't know. Mm. And even in the east of country, my wife is also Scottish, because I like to beat a theme to death. And in the east of the country, the Hibernian and the Hearts in Edinburgh, those are the two Scottish and Catholic and Protestant teams there. And that kind of association of religion with violence, you know, and with and everything that's involved in that was very much a part of my life, but from a distance. I would go back to Scotland every, you know, 4 or 5 years with my parents to take a family vacation. And I would see that, but not really, because, you know, I was just visiting all my family and visiting landmarks and all that, doing the tourist thing. And so that was something that was visible to, or invisible to me, I guess you would say. It was audible to me in my parents' stories, and my father, especially in his stories. And my own sort of answer to place is actually much less weighty and much less profound. You know, it was when I was a little kid and I was reading comic books, you know, everything happened in New York City. And I did not live in New York City. And I wanted the superheroes to be like in the Mid-Hudson Valley, you know. And I remember as a kid drawing comics where I had like, you know, my own superheroes fighting on local bridges and things like that. Because I liked the idea of sort of that element of call it the fantastic intersecting my own life. And when I discovered Stephen King and specifically his novel, Christine, that made such a tremendous impact on me, because it was, you know, that's one of the most supernatural and over the top of his novels. And so having that intersect a high school existence, as it does in that novel, and I'm reading it in high school, I should add, that was, you know, the sort of profound experience for me. And after that, My use of place initially was purely imitative. It was purely Stephen King does this, so I should do this. So a lot of my early horror stories were set in Maine, because I thought, well, obviously that's where all the horror happens. And then I quickly realized, no, let's, you know, set it here. But I didn't have a sense of place as anything other than like a sort of window dressing or maybe a little bit more than that, until I got maybe into college and started reading Faulkner and started reading a lot of those writers of the American South. And that over a period of years really allowed me to think more profoundly about place in my own work. And it's very much part of my work, but I still feel like I've just kind of scratched the surface of it. I feel like there are always little details I'm learning about my place, my little postage stamp of soil, as Faulkner called it, in upstate New York, that sort of make my mind explode. You know, the British burned the local city here, Kingston, to avenge their defeat at Saratoga. And they were, it's a long story, but anyway, while the ships were sailing up the Hudson to Britain, there were kids running through the city shouting, "The British are coming, the British are coming," but they were shouting it in Dutch, because the place was still a profoundly Dutch settlement. And that, you know, that's crazy to me. That's, it shouldn't be, you know, but it, the way that I think of my area, right, is, oh, we're sort of settled and we all speak some kind of English and blah, blah, blah. And in fact, the history is much more dynamic. And I think, it, in so many ways, history is, it's like the subconscious of a place or something like that, you know, in that it affects the conscious, but you're not always aware of why those effects or where those effects are coming from, why those effects are happening.
Yeah. I mean, in both of what you're saying, there's a kind of layering of story in the levels of the earth, you know, there's a way in which the place is holding time. And I think it's interesting for me, moving from the US to Ireland, one of the things that's so comforting to me here is how old everything is. It's not a source of horror, and yet, like, old shit is like in horror stories all the time. I mean, certainly Lovecraft's even and so forth. There's always this idea of this old ancient menace, you know, coming, or corpse mouth for that matter, or something like that. But it's like that there's this old being. But for me, you know, my father's from Syria and my mom's side is almost entirely Irish. And so these two old places, you know, my father would tell me stories of this village he grew up in that didn't have electricity till, you know, the late 20th century. And like, all, you know, hyenas like coming into the village and all that, like these like really sort of old feeling stories. And then coming to Ireland too, and seeing that, oh shit, there's stuff here that's more than 150 years old, you know, like 150 years is not old. There's a joke, I think, probably Sophie, you've heard it, but it's like, you know, an Irish person thinks 200 miles is far and an American thinks 200 years is long. So it's like, yeah, what space is for so Irish true. People, time is for, yeah, you know, Americans, where, I mean, I think when we turn to horror and get horrified by the ancient, I actually find it quite comforting. So this is, and yet, of course I read it in stories and I get scared by it or whatever. So I think I was interested maybe in, did that kind of oldness frighten you, John? And also maybe, I don't know if it frightens you or not, Sophie, or if it's just like, yeah, like there's a castle in my friend's backyard and that's that, a ruined castle in my friend's backyard and that's that, or there's these.
Yeah, yeah. This year.
So, yeah, so I wanted to talk about it in that way as well.
Mm. Yeah, well, in Ireland,
go ahead.
Sorry, I want to hear about the castle in your friend's backyard.
Oh, well, it's just everywhere. It's like everybody in Ireland has a friend with a castle somewhere nearby, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Or I was going to say a fairy fort. Like, the country's littered with fairy forts. And yeah, fairies in Ireland are really like demonic kind of beings. Like, they're not, like, it's really funny when you try and explain to like anyone not from here, like, do not fuck with the fairies.
Right.
And people are picturing like Tinkerbell, and like the fairies in Irish kind of stories are like, they would often like, they'd create chains or, you know, really mess with you if you messed with them. And fairy forts are kind of usually just kind of pretty like basic kind of assemblages of stones, and like any innocent person could totally take a stone from a fairy. I remember there's a story, I host a podcast called The Creep Dive that's all kind of uncanny stories and really messed up stories from the internet and things like that. And one of our listeners got in touch to say that she'd gone on a date with a guy not from here. I think he was English. And he was telling her about how he was building some like thing out in the back of his house, and they'd had to move a few rocks, and she realized she'd taken stones from a fairy fort, and she was just like, I will never see you again. We had a great rapport, but that's it. I can't like be dragged down with you, drag me to hell kind of stuff. Yeah. And like fairy stories inspired murder and things like that. Like there was a case in Kilkenny, I think it was, where a husband became convinced that his wife had been like occupied by the fairies and killed her.
Bridget Cleary, right?
Great excuse. Bridget Cleary. And like, so the oldness, like, I don't know, does it spook me? Like, I grew up in a house that is, I think, about 300 years old, and that would just be quite a casual house in lots of Dublin. A lot of Dublin is Georgian and Victorian, and like, I saw like a ghost pretty early on. Or what I think was a ghost. It was actually like a projection, you know, in the bathroom of my parents' house. And it like was really fascinating because I was like in the bath and I had these kind of candles lit because I was like a 14-year-old goth, you know. And I was probably in there reading Carrie and like bath with candles. It was long before self-care or any bullshit. And I noticed on the wall behind me the silhouette of a woman. It's quite large and it was very distinctive. I mean, she was in profile and it was unmistakable. And I thought, like, Jesus. And I was kind of moving things around to see if something was casting this shadow, and I couldn't find anything. And I got up out of the bath and turned the big light on, and obviously she disappeared. And then I turned the light off again and she was still there. And I did it one more time, turned the light on and she disappeared. And when I turned it off again, she was gone. And I had nothing, like nothing. I hadn't moved anything. It was just gone. And so like, I think oldness is kind of just sort of the quotidian in Ireland. Like, I guess we have old shit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't mess with it.
I want to just say something.
And I always remember my mom, my mom being like, really, she does not hold with any of this, like ghosts or anything like that. But I always remember her really impressing on me when I was younger not to do the Ouija board. And I thought, well, like, that's, you know, like, she's got enough respect for it all to just, you know, I think she would have rathered I, you know, like, smoked crack than did the Ouija board.
Well, yeah. And so just to like say this, and then like, maybe John, if you want to jump in, I think that experience of just the everydayness of what in America would be considered supernatural, it's pretty striking. Like, even here in Dublin, you know, I mean, I have friends who, you're walking through the park, if there's mushrooms, they'll kind of push you out of the way and be like, don't walk through that. It doesn't matter how, like, they can work for the tech company and still be like, no, don't do that. And then, you know, the more sort of in the country you get, the more just obvious and literal it becomes, where people are like, oh yeah, like, I saw a leprechaun, I saw these fairies out in the field today, this and this. And, you know, even politicians have talked about fairies here. I mean, it's a certain family of politicians that are maybe not considered the most reputable people in Ireland, but it, you know, they talk about them in terms of policies, and there have been policies around fairies and stuff like that. And the interesting thing for me, and why it comes like chiming in when you said the thing about Bridget Cleary, is so this woman who was burned to death by her husband, who believed she had been sort of swapped for a fairy, maybe the road of mother motivations, maybe not, but it became international news and people were kind of like, ho ho, the Irish believing in this stuff. But at that time, the priests and like Ireland was, I wouldn't say it was modernizing, but there was a kind of coexistence of priests and people that understood and knew a bit more about fairy traditions and all that. So a priest came to the house, but also a fairy doctor like consulted with the, and a fairy doctor is just, I don't exactly know how to describe it, but someone who knew about these things essentially consulted with the husband. Now, this is where it kind of leads to something I heard you say in or maybe read you say in an interview, John. It's like someone asked you about, do you believe in supernatural stuff? Which I think is a great thing to always ask horror writers who write about supernatural stuff, because I do want to know that. Have you had these experiences or not? Sometimes I find myself trying to convince horror writers that they do. Like when I had Paul Tremblay on the show, I was like, are you sure you don't believe in ghosts? And he was like, okay, maybe a little bit. I don't know. But I think for me in America, the landscape is like, there's such intense response to supernatural, the paranormal. It's so huge in media in America. And there's this like huge tension between whether or not it exists or not. And I think part of that actually has to do with like not having a tradition of people that could really distinguish or understand the supernatural phenomena. Whereas here, there are those fairy doctors, there are diviners now still. There are, you know, there was a place for it in culture where there was a way to sort of distinguish when the experiences were real, when they were fake. And even though the fairy doctors aren't mostly around anymore, there are still some, they don't, like, there's still a kind of a cultural distinction or a cultural apparatus that allows people to sort of think about these things. And so I wanted to maybe bring that to you, and your sort of wavering belief is kind of what I read in the interview that you gave. And then also just the kind of landscape of America about these things. And then I suppose we'll talk about horror fiction at some point too, but but just to bring that to you. Yeah.
I mean, I would like to answer that question backwards and try to avoid answering the first part. I don't mean to put my professor head on it, I'm sorry. But I think in American culture, and I guess by that I mean European American culture, to some extent it goes back to the Puritans, and it goes back to the Protestant doctrine of cessationism, which is something that comes out of the Protestant Reformation, which says miracles are done. There are no more miracles. God is not acting in the world anymore. If there's any supernatural thing that you see, that's the devil. And that makes everything really simple. And so when the Puritans come here, they find themselves, in these little encampments where they're surrounded by this vast forest that they're utterly terrified of, and in which they, all kinds of strange things happen. Most of them, I suspect, entirely natural, with entirely natural explanations, but the Puritans read them as supernatural and therefore as the province of the devil. And this is something I think, a writer like Hawthorne really gets at least kind of emotionally speaking in his stories, right? Is just that it's all the devil all the time out there. And so I think that, I think America has this, and obviously the witch trials that come at the quite late in some ways in the Puritan period are all about that, are all about that, the infiltration, if you will, of something other than Orthodox or a certain Orthodox kind of Christianity into the social sphere. And that has to be, that has to be purged. That provokes a panic and that has to be purged. And so I think that in some ways, and remember too that the witch trials and Puritan, that is all institutional. That is not something that just, it happens and the government's like, oh my God, the government is like, let's go. This is, who else are we going to hang? Right. Who else are we going to crush under a bunch of rocks? So that there is this, I think, in our history, brief as it may be in comparison, there is this real suspicion of the supernatural, this fear of the supernatural, because the supernatural can only mean one thing. It can only mean the devil. It can only mean bad things for you. And, you know, this also, it intersects with the politics of land expansion and of class, you know, oh, we have to civilize the natives, we have to baptize them, we have to make them Christians, because when we do that, they'll be part of our community and, you know, we can take their land. It's easier to do that, mm-hmm. or we can split them and they'll help us take their land. So I think that for the United States, and in some ways, you know, you could, the plus side of the American experiment is the First Amendment, is the Establishment Clause, is no official religion. We're not a Christian nation. We never have been. We never should be. Or any other kind of religion, that religion is a matter of conscience. But I think, the experience of the weird, the numinous, however you want to look at that, is something that we have a difficult time talking about. And it is interesting that so much of American literature, mainstream, as it were, American literature, involves the weird, the supernatural in some way. You know, go back to, Poe, of course. What's his name? Charles Brockden Brown, who writes these gothic novels about a guy who hears the voice of God telling him to kill people. And then it turns out it was just a ventriloquist. It's like the scoop. America loves an evil ventriloquist. Is there any other kind? But America loves the Scooby-Doo story, you know, where it seems like there's some monster, but at the end you pull off the mask and it's just old Mr. Jenkins. So I think that, and so I'm saying this, but what I'm also thinking to myself is that there's also in other kinds of American religious tradition, especially, you know, and here, this is all Protestant. I'm not even getting to the whole influx of Catholics in the later 19th century, but, you know, you have exorcisms of various kinds, right? That remains, casting out the devil, that remains a thing. But then also you get things like snake handling and speaking in tongues and these kinds of ecstatic experiences of spirituality, which are way outside of what I would think of as, I mean, I was raised Catholic, 12 years of Catholic school. So this is very outside the box in a lot of ways. And so I think that if you go into more rural American culture, you find the persistence of certain kinds of folk culture and folk beliefs vis-a-vis different supernatural figures and so on. Manly Wade Wellman writes about these in his Silver John stories. So I think that, but the thing is that those, and I think there, To get back to your point, Connor, like in those kinds of cultural situations, I think it's possible, you don't exactly have a fairy doctor, but it is possible for a kind of folk belief that is maybe more in touch with its pagan roots to coexist with a Christian, a more Christian, Orthodox Christian viewpoint. But I think in the bigger cities and that, I don't know that that's the case. This is where I kind of reach the limits of, you know, as more and more people move to cities, how do things change? I'm not 100% sure. And I wouldn't be surprised if in small neighborhoods, and I mean, a place like New York City is nothing but a collection of small neighborhoods, but yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if there were local folk beliefs there that sort of attached to a particular area.
Yeah. And I think there's a kind of horror that would see the absence of being in touch with those things as its own kind of horror. So when you talk about the cities, I'm thinking about one of the greatest horror stories of all time, which is The Whimper of Whipped Dogs by Harlan Ellison, where someone gets killed. It's sort of loosely based on a story that maybe this was what happened or not. A woman gets killed sort of in the courtyard of a building, and all the people kind of watching don't do anything. The lights just come on. Yeah. Kitty Genovese is the, was her name, but it's not clear if that's actually what happened or not now, but anyway, everybody sort of watched and there's this evil being kind of watching them watch. And so the idea is that like in the city, there's this kind of evil that seizes people as well, in their unknowingness of how gods work. And again, you know, maybe that's sort of a Lovecraftian thing as well. The unknowingness of the gods is actually the real danger. And I always find that really interesting. So many horror stories are about people, what people believe or don't believe, how they're protected by believing or not believing in certain things. While we're talking about like sort of places and the kind of spirits that inhere there, you've both written a lot about water, water in your work. And I was thinking about the elements as well. You know, and the obvious are, you know, where I end in the fisherman, but also, you know, John, you have plenty of stories that have kind of horror inherent in the water. And so I wanted to think about those too, the ways that it's not just the land or where we live, but also the elements themselves that have a certain kind of horror quality. Water seems like the most obvious, but then I wonder if we could, I'm sure this is not true, if this is just way too neat, but I like thinking of each horror writer as maybe represented by a certain element, or drawn to a certain element to write about the horror of that element. And I know that I'm sure that that's not correct, but I like the idea of it. Since I have you both here, yeah, and you write like about water, idea. You guys can be the water horror writers and we can talk about that for a little bit.
Cool.
And you kind of can be sort of considered to be in that sort of
a little bit,
yeah, as well.
Yeah.
You know, isn't that funny? Yeah. Do you feel like you have identification with that kind of categorization, John?
Do you know, I hate to
identify as a water man.
I hate to admit it, but I do. I have no belief whatsoever in astrology. However,
I sensed a but. Exactly. Spoken like a man who somewhat believes in
this. Exactly, sounds like a Pisces statement coming up.
It turns out I'm going to answer that earlier question whether I wanted to or not. No, I was born, my astrological sign is a Cancer, the crab, and it's a lunar thing and it's related to the water. And man, you know, for as early as I can remember, like it seemed like all the trouble that my family had, like say when I was growing up with our house, was water related. The basement would flood when we had too much rain. We were sitting over some kind of underground stream and it would rise up into the basement, sometimes quite high. And I've always been afraid. I like the water. Like I like to be at the beach and I don't even mind going into the water a little bit, but there are moments when I'm suddenly aware of just how immense the ocean is. Mm. I was quite some years ago, maybe 10 years ago. My wife and I took our son to a beach on Cape Cod and it was lovely and the tide was out and you could walk way, 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 way out. And the water was only maybe waist deep. And so I walked all the way out and the water was clear and I'm looking down. And you know, I could hear the beach getting farther and farther away. And suddenly this shoal of fish shot by me and they were huge. I think they were sea bass maybe. Mm-hmm. So each one was say, you know, 3 feet long, something like that. And it was a little startling, but it was also kind of lovely. But then I had this moment where I thought, what are they running away from? Those are big fish. And I was suddenly aware I am very far away from the shore. And mm-hmm. I turned around and you know, I'm not a great swimmer, and it's really hard to run. You just have to, you know, you're just sort of wading forward in the water. And I thought, what a stupid way to die this would be. You know, the sea monster gets me in my slow motion escape. So, yeah, I have found, once in a while, when I revisit my own writing, there were certain things that pop up a lot, and water is one of them. And I thought, man, that's weird. I wasn't aware of that. And sometimes at one point I was kind of self-conscious about it. No writer likes to feel that, you're just a one trick pony, but, my good friend Laird Barron was just like, that's your thing. Just lean into it. You know, you're not going to do it every time, but just if that's where your subconscious is taking you, go with it. And I think that was great advice, quite frankly.
I mean, Dublin's a great place for sea swimming. Everyone in Ireland loves sea swimming pretty much. And I grew up swimming in the sea, just outside the city. And, have always loved it. It's funny because I find the sea to be in many ways quite a comforting place in that it's obviously very, very cold here, John. And I think you can't get into the Irish Sea without your kind of nervous system becoming just regulated. Like, you know, it just does, it's like the sea does it for you. It just kind of, your kind of lungs will seize for a minute, and then the lungs almost kind of like follow the pattern of the sea suddenly. And it can be such a, like, I don't, just a reset. It's very, like, comforting. And when I wrote a collection of essays that was like nonfiction, but very kind of gothic nonfiction. You know, I talked about after losing my dad, sort of going through the grief of that and the kind of horror that is grief and the kind of haunting. It's kind of a personal haunting. I found a lot of solace in the sea because he was such a big swimmer, and you know, a lot of my memories of him were in the sea and things like that. And then, I mean, obviously, see, I kind of guess I'm very interested in the fact that the sea is like a parent, in that you can like seek this comfort and solace, but that, I mean, for so many children, your parent is your first bully. And so, you know, so many children, we have this like incredible terror of our parents because we know their unpredictability, like with an intimacy that no one else in the world knows. And it's a story that may not be believed, even if you try to tell someone, you know. And then so I kind of think of the sea in those kind of two sort of ways, that it's a kind of a, you know, a mercurial parent that has to be appeased. And I think that's real Irish real island superstitious stuff. You know, like Where I End is set on an island, and it's, you know, based, you know, somewhat on a real island off the coast of the west of Ireland called Inishman, that is a stunning place. And, you know, really Inishman only inspired the novel insofar as it has an incredibly unusual and strange and really beautiful landscape kind of topography. It slices up out of the ocean, and has on one end this kind of like beguilingly beautiful sandy beach, and then on the other this like absolute kind of like sheer drop off cliffs. And it's such a fascinating place. And I think with Where I End, like the ocean is a big character in the story, in terms of like the islanders and Where I End, like they fish, it is their livelihood, but it's also like over and over again their demise, you know. And the kind of islanders have kind of like worked up a kind of protocol of superstitious customs to appease this cruel parent. And then they've also come up with these kind of practicalities around it, around the fact that the sea kind of murders their men. And this is a real thing from the west of Ireland, which is in the book. I kind of flipped it wholesale and put it into the book, that families, so the Aran jumpers come from this part of Ireland, and they're very famous. It's obviously knitted Ganzis, and families of these kind of island communities would stitch or knit in a special kind of turn in the pattern or in the cable, so that when they're dead, washed ashore, and were potentially like completely mutilated by the sea and no longer recognizable, they'd be able to tell they're dead from the turn of the cable in the jumper and things, you know, which like totally fascinated me. Mm-hmm. And I think with Where I End, I particularly was really interested in the sea meeting the land and that kind of transitional space. Because, you know, I kind of find, like, I find sandy beaches quite creepy. Just in that way that, like, you know, they're shape-shifting constantly. And they're, you know, they can sort of, like, swallow you things and you. And I always loved, my kids were on the sand of the beach the other day, and they were burying each other. And I loved, like, tell me that your mother is a horror writer without telling me your mother's a horror writer. I was encouraging them. They were burying my middle boy. He's six. And I was like, just bury everything except his arms and just leave his arms out. And it'll look like limbs. It'll look like a dismembered corpse, I shouted gaily across the beach to my 9, 6, and 3-year-old. But like, I love all that kind of stuff. Like, and there, the thing on the island in Where I End is there's this really unusual ritual around burial of the dead. That is, again, it's kind of a thing that is comes about for practical reasons. They can't dig the island because it's made of like limestone, and the soil layer is just like, you know, barely a foot deep. And so they come up with this like quote unquote solution that is totally horrendous and macabre, but it's completely a part of their lives and they don't even, you know. And that solution is also very connected to the sea, very connected to the sea meets land and how turbulent that transitional space can be. And I guess I really like that idea of like situating characters and events right there on the edge, because it's such a place of like nearly being safe and then nearly being totally fucked and doomed, you know.
Right.
And yeah. I think that that's like the best moments in horror is when there's still that last hope, you know.
Yeah.
So I love the sea.
Yeah, I mean, that's I feel like my whole life has been kind of lived on that line. I don't mean between certain doom and, you know, just a happy life necessarily, but that ecotone is the name between the two ecosystems where, you know, you're kind of, if you stand with one foot in the field and one foot in the forest, you get a bit of both and they can blend in weird ways. And I think you're right that a lot of horror happens there. You know, even my birthday is like on a cusp day. It's August 23rd, so it's in a few days, but it's like the Virgo Leo cusp day. Sorry to bring up astrology, John, but but to, you know, to have these two like characters sort of blended in. So I think that, you know, that is the site for horror, really, is where there's this, you know, this edge. It's one of the many sites. But I'm interested too, because in this difference in approaches to water, because I'm thinking, well, you know, in Ireland, there aren't any dangerous animals at all. Like, they're ticks, but that's about it. Like, you know, in America, even in New York State, you might have a bear, there's a couple poisonous snakes, one poisonous spider, but still you can get messed up by some of the animal world. But certainly if you go to the ocean, there's sharks here. The sharks are like these big sharks with no teeth, which is like, that's about it. You know, there are killer whales here, and who knows which direction they'll go in the coming animal revolution, but there are killer whales here, but that's about it. There's nothing really dangerous. And I'm thinking about the fact that, you know, as you were saying, the sea has this mothering kind of presence and et cetera. And I feel that sort of the same way of Hawk Mountain, where the ocean has its own kind of presence. But John writes about things that are in the water. So there might be a water theme as well, but something that's in the water that's threatening. Whereas we're writing about, you know, like the entire system there having its own presence, maybe sinister, maybe not sinister. But a monster that's in the element is a little bit different. And I think that that's also like just this weird, I mean, I guess I can't ascribe that exactly to America versus Ireland, because I lived in the US most of my life. And, you know, the Hawk Mountain takes place in the US and all that. But I do think that there's maybe something to that where, you know, yeah, I mean, that island idea that the sea is its own kind of being is different. You don't necessarily have to put anything even in it that's threatening, you know?
Sure, yeah, sure. Yeah. And I think it's so interesting, John, that like with you, like, the fisherman, like, I didn't realize that you were Scottish, like, and like, isn't that interesting? You know, obviously the Loch Ness monster, and then the kind of, you know, monsters that you kind of deal in at times, and certainly in that book, you know, there's kind of like a bit of overlap there. I mean, is there, have you got an interest in the kind of lore of those sort of places, in like the real life lore of them?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. When my wife and I got together, and we spent, her family is from the East Coast of Scotland. Actually, and what's funny, just as an aside, is this reminds me of what Connor was saying earlier, you know, the middle of Scotland, the kind of skinny waist of Scotland, you can get from one side to the other in an hour and a half tops. But, you know, for my in-laws, you know, that's the West Coast. It's like me saying, if I'm like, well, why don't we just go there? It's like, it would be like someone saying to me, well, can't we just go to California? I'd be like, right. that's the West Coast, you know, but the sort of the mental distance is astonishing. But yeah, when we got together, I was at that time, I was working on a PhD that I never finished. And my early research, I was thinking, oh, I want to do something on Scottish sort of literature, culture. And I was thinking about the Scottish novel in the 20th century and people like Alistair Gray and Ian Banks. And so I wound up doing a certain amount of research into, you know, sort of Scottish folk traditions and so on. There's a wonderful book, Canongate Press in Edinburgh, reissued all these Scottish writers who were hard to find, out of print or what have you. And there was this wonderful book called The Silver Birch, which was, and I wish I could remember the name of the woman who wrote it, but it was, or The Silver Bough, excuse me. It was an attempt to sort of do for Scotland's folk culture what the Golden Bough had done for, you know, kind of Western folk culture, like draw everything together. And it's this wonderful compendium of all these weird Scottish beliefs. I don't know if how true they are, or I don't know what research the person, I presume that they did, but yeah, I was fascinated as a kid by Scotland as a medieval place, or in medieval terms, you know, Robert the Bruce and William Wallace was never such a big deal to me. I mean, later on, yes, oh, Mel Gibson gets tortured to death, which I guess is a good thing. But yeah, I was interested in, you know, sort of knights in shining armor and that sort of stuff. And then also, the sort of Viking influence, you know, this is, you know, you were fighting Vikings and they were coming ashore and hooray. And so all of that really appealed to me when I was a kid. And I think as I've gotten older, that still appeals to me. I mean, if I'm being honest, I'm still kind of fascinated by all of that stuff. I'm even more fascinated though by the way in which there are cultural traces in Scotland of say the Picts. But a lot of what we have are images without context. My wife has friends in the Shetland Islands. And so we went up to Shetland and we were wandering around there. We went into one of their museums and there was, I'm pretty sure it was a Pictish image and it was rather large, and it was of a dog-headed man. And there was just no context for it whatsoever. Is this a god? Is this a monster? What is this thing? And I love that. I love that, you know, the same thing with Pictish writing. There were places is where you can find Pictish symbols, and they're just, you know, they're lines with circles, sort of intersecting concentric circles, say, and with a crescent in part of them, and you'll just think, is this astrological? Is this in some way temporal? Like what is this? And so I run riot with that kind of stuff, and I feel a little bit bad sometimes. I'm sure there's some anthropologist out there who reads this and it's like, what do you think you're doing? That's not responsible. But yeah, and I think that's something about. Yes, maybe this takes us back to notions of history, but I'm fascinated by the idea of history that is present but mysterious. You know, that we see Stonehenge, right? Is that what is Stonehenge, right? You know, and I find that there's some of that here. Even there are places in the U.S. That there in Lovecraft's time, there were what looked like standing stones on top of local mountains in the Berkshires, mm-hmm. in the west of Massachusetts. The scientists now think that they're just sort of peculiar natural formations, but that is what they would want you to think, isn't it?
Yeah.
Typical. This goes right to the top.
The top of the mountain.
right to the top. It's big Pictish image wants us to think one way, and science wants us. But I think like the way I'm thinking about that, then what you're saying, John, and maybe blending some of these things together, is one of my favorite books that I've read in the past few years. I've probably brought it up on the show like 100 times, but it's called Cold Iron. And it's about the occupational lore of Irish fishermen on the west coast of Ireland and the things they can say and not say when they're on the boats. Don't ever bring up any land animal when you're on the boat because of the luck it'll bring. And there's a weird way in which it almost mirrors, like, if you say the name of the animal, like if you say a pig or dog or whatever, or fox, then the water version of it will come and get you somehow, which is this weird, like, other world kind of valence or something like that. So I think, but the thing that's interesting to me about that in reference to what you're saying is there's this whole wisdom that's held, and some fishermen still use this, some not, like some of it's faded out since the 70s, but there's this whole kind of wisdom that's held that has like deep theory connected to time that's, we can't quite understand it anymore because the pictures are still there. The notion of what to do in some sense is still there, but some of the reason is left out. And that's something I think is just true about monsters in general. When Kelly Link and Jordy Rosenberg were on the show a long time ago, I was talking about how, like, with them, like, vampires, like, a vampire is a theory, is the sort of subtitle of that episode. Like, a vampire is, you know, and other monsters, they're theories where, like, instead of just being archetypes, which I think is how people mostly think of them, I think of them almost as like theories that the contours of the theory can't just be delineated by theoretical language. It has to be living, or it has to encounter us as a person for us to work with the theory. It has to be felt and experienced. It can't just be intellectual. And so I think that some of what you're talking about is the same feeling that we have when we encounter monsters, that we're encountering a sort of a theory that's been set loose on the world with its own limits, its own, and very often it'll tell us something about the human body. It'll tell us something about death. It'll tell us something about landscape, whatever it is. And it's just kind of moving in the world rather than being, I don't want to say inert on the page, because obviously I don't think words are inert, but it's not laying flat. It meets us.
No one understands vampires like me. it's so funny the way you've described it there, in terms of, like, you can only understand it by encountering it. I in that collection of essays that I mentioned, that's called Corpsing, My Body and Other Horror Shows. So it's very, I'm such a horror fan, you see. So before I wrote any horror, it found its way into this nonfiction enterprise. And one of the essays in it is called Craving. And it was kind of born out of, I was pregnant and I had this absolute like completely insatiable, obviously insatiable, is quite tricky to satisfy this craving for blood. I really, really was obsessed with this desire to drink blood. And it's such an inconvenient one, you know. I was flat out looking for dodgy phlebotomists and and asking, just trying to float it real casually in conversations with my friends as well and things like that. And you know, I was, because I was looking I was trying all kinds of bullshit that wasn't really scratching the itch, like very rare steaks. And I was obviously anemic, but obviously craving things during pregnancy, it's very, like, you know, I think kind of elemental. Like, I quite liked the idea that I was kind of being occupied by this entity that was like Audrey 2 in Little Shop of Horrors, like, you know, feed me blood. And I was trying to kind of, I suppose, interrogate the whole thing and really think about the kind of how troublesome it is to have a desire that is so, like, completely taboo. And, like, oh, I went down such great kind of different little garden paths, like, you know, do you know that interview with the necrophiliac, Karen Greenleaf? Have you ever come across it? It's such a great interview. I'm just, look at me beaming. I'm like, me and Karen, we've so much in common. She did an interview with, it's an American writer who wrote this brilliant book that's like Apocalypse Culture, I think is what it's called. It's nonfiction. And so he interviewed this necrophiliac, and that was great fun for me. And I got really into then the kind of fact that, like, Dracula can be read as like a famine text, which, like, I thought was so interesting. And obviously a lot of the kind of lesser acknowledged realities of the Irish famine is there was cannibalism, and, you know, and they did drink, I'm sure they got up to loads. Like, of course you would, because you're just trying to live. Like, and that famine is like our very own homegrown kind of zombie apocalypse as well. Like, because, you know, from reading about it, it seems that the roads of Ireland were just like, they were just teeming with these kind of, like, you know, barely living kind of corpses, you know. So in the end, like, I decided to get pig's blood. And I wasn't totally thrilled with the idea, because the blood thing was very tied to a particular image that, like, I wanted to be like crouching under a kind of gushing wound. And I was like, really, now kind of rude that no one is facilitating this for me. And I'm pregnant and bringing forth life, it's the least. And it's very, like, I mean, it's interesting because it got so into the whole like vampirism in America. And, like, I think there's a big kind of pocket of vampires in New Orleans who have their, I think they call themselves sangs, and then they have black swans are their very generous donors. And I was like, you know, deep into Reddit trying to find, like, a few local kind of like-minded people. And it was just so annoying. And in the end, I said, okay, I'll just try the pig's blood. And it was in the middle of lockdown in Ireland. And it was a funny old one, because it's hard enough to get a butcher that has a lot of pig's blood on hand, but there was one in Mead Street. And it was out of my radius. You know, you could only travel like 2K or whatever. And so I had to text my friend who was, like, on the kind of cusp, like on the Venn diagram of our sort of areas we could travel within. And I had to get her to go and collect the pig's blood for me and then bring it down to me. And I remember I didn't get to the door in time, and my then 4-year-old opened the door. And he was in that real helpful phase that they get into, where it's like, I will fucking help with this and you won't stop me. And he got a hold of the blood And like the thing was about the size of him, and he was like staggering around the hall and like trying to carry this pig's blood for me. And I was like, just put it in the kitchen. And it was very stressful. And then like the long and the short of it is that like pig's blood is just a pale imitation of crouching under a beautiful woman's gushing neck wound. And that whole thing now really did make me think, you know, about vampires as being just the most kind of logical sort of monster, if you want to call them that, in terms of like, you know, it's such a like basic one. You could have a bit of a deficiency. You're just trying to satisfy the deficiency. Then there is a kind of an eroticism, but they're all appetites that are so wholly human, really. Isn't it funny?
So there's so many directions there. So if you did take it, I'm thinking of so many things. One, there's like a chapter or a section in The Argonauts by Maggie Nelson, where she writes about breastfeeding as having this erotic quality. And I know you've written also about breastfeeding as well. I'm thinking about John's story in The Wide Carnivorous Sky about a space vampire, which is a wholly like a different kind of vampire that has its own life, that doesn't look like something even close to us. And yet we can recognize it as a vampire, which is also bizarre. Like where do we draw the lines? But I think maybe the place that I'm most interested in taking is maybe like threading it back into the paranormal thing a little bit that we were talking about before, where, so John, in The Fisherman, you have this part where these weird tadpoles with an eye on them spill out of someone's mouth. And there's a line in there, I forget the exact line, but it's something like, you know, you might be able to like kind of go along with this story up to this point, like sure, ghosts, people rising from the dead, whatever. But as soon as these tadpoles come out, you know, like now we're pushing it. And the reason why I'm thinking about that in terms of vampires is, you know, I met this guy here in Ireland that, it was two years after I moved here, and we were just having a regular conversation. And then he kind of interrupted and he said, you know, my best friend was killed by vampires here. And I was like, what? He's like, I know, but he was murdered by a group of vampires in Ireland. And I still think about that because I think to the contrary of what you were saying, Sophie, about being like, well, it's really understandable. Although now maybe I'm kind of looking at you suspiciously, but I think
that it's in the long plan for her to get this close to you.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. You're joining the hordes of people who don't want to be alone with me.
This is my Van Helsing moment. And that vampire was Sophie White. No, but I think, if someone says, oh, I saw a ghost, even your story about the ghost before in the tub or whatever, and I like the loop back into pig's blood and reading Carrie there as well. But the telling of a ghost story to someone, okay, kind of got it. But if you tell someone that someone was killed by vampires, you're like, not so sure I can go down that path with you. And again, it kind of loops back in. Like, if I told someone here that I saw fairies, like I saw these blue lights in a field in the West once hovering over the ground, and someone else who was with me saw them too, everybody would be like, yeah, okay. You know, they might still think it was a little wild, but they'd be like, yeah, all right. But I'm interested in that place. And John, maybe we can talk about it too, that demarcation between, I'm willing to go with you. No, I'm not willing to go with you. Because you wrote, it's such a striking moment in that story because it is exactly addressing what's happening internally in the reader. Like, whoa, we're on a different level now of where we believe and where we don't believe and how far we're willing to go and the kind of fear it brings out in us to cross that line, or maybe the rejection or the resistance to crossing that line, even as taking in fiction, much less reality claims, and so on and so forth.
Man, there is, I feel like there's so much to respond to, you know, it's almost dizzying to try to think through it. I was thinking that, okay, so my one supernatural or quasi supernatural experience happened the morning of my father's funeral. I was the last one in my parents' house. They have a very tiny house. And I was just sort of locking up basically on my way out the door to get in my car and drive to the church. And where I was standing at the head of our living room, in our dining room, and you could sort of look down to the other end of the house, again, which is very small. It was a bright, sunny morning. That end of the house, the other end of the house was sort of dim, but in that weird kind of dimness that is on the other side of sunshine, if that makes any sense, where it's almost sort of, there's like sort of gold in there, you know? And, I said something to my father, like, oh, you know, I was always late. I'm coming. And I heard him whisper my name, just John in my ear. And it was, he had been in the hospital for 2 months before this. He had been intubated. So it was the way I suppose his voice might very well have sounded. And I looked down the hallway and I was suddenly absolutely positive that if I had gone down into that kind of golden darkness and opened one of the bedroom doors there, I would have found him. And I was like, nope. And I sort of rationalized it to myself, I guess, as I got to get to the funeral. And so I left. And whether it was that I was afraid I wouldn't find him there, or I was afraid I would find him there, I'm not sure. But those kinds of moments that I feel like those kinds of sort of, you know, liminal moments. And look, anybody listening to this would say to me, how much sleep had you been getting? How stressed? My father died very suddenly when all was said and done. Like I myself would admit to all sorts of kind of quasi rationalizations for that experience. And even if you want to say, well, you know, perhaps the membrane, you know, perhaps he was pressed up against the membrane that separates worlds, just reaching out to just give me a little reassurance or something. Like, we can accept that, I think. But when you start to push over, my father, who, as I said, you know, was a devout Catholic. One of the great things about growing up in a Catholic household was you heard all these utterly insane stories. And I don't just mean the lives of the saints. I mean, you know, my father told me this story about these, you know, and when he was growing up in Scotland, there were these nefarious wrongdoers, i.e. Protestants, who had gone into the local church and they had stolen a consecrated host and they were going to do something to it. I mean, you know, you can just imagine. Like, anyway, so they bring the host to their hideout and they put it on a plate on their table while they try to decide what to do, you know? And you know, my father is telling me this made absolute sense to him, you know. Well, suddenly the host starts to bleed and blood just starts to pour out of the host, and it fills up the dish and it spills over the edges of the dish and down the sides of the table. And of course the Protestants freak out and they take the host and they immediately return it to the church. And my father said, you know, when he had said, side note, what happened to that blood? Anyway, that's the stuff.
Sophie drank it.
I know. Yeah. I'm particularly interested.
That's the Holy Grail.
Is there any going? Obviously, that's all I need to do. I need to just go and steal a host.
You know? And my father
said, it's so fascinating because they stole the body. Like, right.
And so here's the thing. My father claimed that he knew a priest who had been on the altar with another priest when that host was used in the mass. And you could see that it had this little, like, sort of brown bit at the end where it had bled from. Right. So that story goes right to, like, the vampire level. You know, like that goes to, I mean, you know, and my father would have sworn by that story. I think I'm pretty sure he would not have said, you know, come on, why were they stealing a host in the first place? You know, or this is probably some other kind of folk story that got, you know, for him, that was my story of hearing his voice place for him would have been of a piece along a line of continuity with that story about the bleeding host. And so I think that there's something that is kind of interesting there that most of us, I feel like Paul, are willing to go to the border. We're willing to go to the border and we're willing to say, well, yeah, maybe there could be something weird, but perhaps it's a kind of psychic echo or something along those lines. And that's what we're hearing when we see a ghost. That's what we're seeing. But when the supernatural, when there were vampires, there's a gang of vampires roaming around, just three guys, you would never even know that they were vampires. But those three guys, you know, if you run afoul of them, or maybe if not, they will drink your blood. Like, that pushes it just over into another kind of realm of experience that I don't think we want to experience. I feel like I would not be talking to people from Ireland if I did not mention James Joyce. And I think that Joyce had something to the effect of, the advantage of being Catholic and believing all the ridiculous Catholic stuff is that it prevents you from believing all the other ridiculous stuff. You know, that there was like, and so I think that's the thing, right? That like, you know, that as long as you have this kind of belief system, you can say, well, of course that's ridiculous, but it works within this context. And I feel like the vampire story, that takes you outside of any kind of context. And I love the idea of a theory that's just sort of roaming the world, and then it smacks into a situation and it shapes itself to that. It's sort of reactive. It shapes itself to that situation. And I feel like that's what you get with the story of the friend or the guy and the vampires, you know, is this theory that kind of smacks into us, but there's no larger narrative that we have to make sense of that, I think.
Yeah. Well, for, I also just bring in the Irish thing in, I love that you created a term which echoes a famous book of Irish poetry, which is The Spirit Level by Seamus Heaney. And you called it the vampire level. I love the idea that we hit a certain level in belief and acceptability, and it's like, oh, we're in the vampire level now, you know? Yeah. And also sounds like a video game or a RPG or something like that, where you
get, well, you don't want to, it's great if you can reach a vampire, but the boss there is tough, man.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
you got to go back to the level 3 and get the garlic.
Totally. Something else I wanted to talk about was the theme of caretaking in horror, and obviously this is at the center of Where I End, but it also is in some of your stories, John, and the one that I'm most thinking about is Corpse Mouth. And in fact, in both of those, there's someone doing kind of indecipherable writing that has to be kind of decoded, and I'm thinking about that, staying close with, holding on to someone who is you know, in proximity to death. Again, there's this kind of like ecotone, you know, you're in one realm and in the other kind of feel there. But that concept of horror, one of the things it's interesting for me, because I was like a sex worker for a long time. A lot of sex workers end up becoming hospice workers because we're not afraid of touching bodies or, you know, anything that would seem necessarily repulsive, maybe to someone else. Like, to us, we're like, oh, I can work with this. I can deal with this. And you kind of find your way in, and not being afraid of touch or intimacy with someone whose body might not be the kind of body you necessarily want to be around. And yet, I'm getting still, like, I still get a sense of horror when I read stuff like yours, or there's, you know, that story, I think it's called Grandma by Stephen King, which later kind of surfaced in Pet Sematary. There's a story just almost exactly like that story, but it's much older. I always wonder if Stephen King read it, called Finger Finger, about an old woman who is, you know, being caretaken and wants to jump into the soul of someone else. But these, I forget the author, otherwise I would say it, but I'll put it in the show notes. But these, the idea of the body being there, in some ways, it's almost like a zombie story. You know, it's almost like that end of Shaun of the Dead, where he's like hanging out with his best friend tied up, or, you know, in the basement or whatever.
Yeah, playing video games. Yeah.
So
right.
I want to talk about that caretaking aspect. And, you know, when someone's speaking to you in an indecipherable language, and maybe it's indicating a kind of suffering or a kind of confusion, as the theme.
I had to have a couple of teeth removed. I had root canals that had failed. And when the doctor, the oral surgeon, took them out, he said, okay, we're going to put implants in, but your jawbone is kind of like worn down a bit. So what we're going to do is open up your gums and put in some cadaver bone, and that'll graft. And so I was talking about this with a friend, and I said, oh, just call me Corpse Mouth. And I was like, oh, we were both like, oh my God, that's a title. And there's a whole, I feel like there's a whole other story in that, you know, like one of those sort of 70s era movies about, you know, you get the transplant and then suddenly you're speaking in the voice of the dead, and it turned out it was the mouth of a serial killer or something like that, you know?
Because that is, I just want to jump in and say something there real quickly before we get too far away from it. That's something that lots of doctors who do transplants report, is that their patients then do have memories of the person who had the transplanted organ. And I talked to someone who was a liver doc, like a liver doctor, about this, and he's like, no one ever wants to talk about this in the medical field, but it happens all the time. So maybe you've got a little bit of bone graft memory in your mouth there as well.
Yeah, I figured that they probably scrub the cadaver bone, you know, like it's so they probably, like, I don't know, dip it in bleach to get rid of all the DNA or something. But yeah, who knows? I guess there is something horrifying right about the way that your body can break down. And also about seeing your loved ones breaking down. I think if you're a child looking at your parent, right, when my father had, and this is all actually in the story, you know, my father had two sort of consecutive heart attacks when I was 13. And he was before that just a sort of unstoppable force of nature. You know, he was very strong and just go. And after that, he was not. He had a really, the next 10 years in a way were him struggling against that, struggling against this sort of way in which his life had kind of shrunk for him. And so I think that for me, that was really, that was difficult to see. I think for anybody, that's difficult to see. I think for anybody who just inevitably, even if everything goes okay, even if your life has, I don't know, no major tragedies, you know, eventually your parents get older, they start to decline. That's a difficult thing to see. And of course, who lives a life like that? Who lives a life that is that calm and uncomplicated? Obviously, the other way around too, for a parent to see a child in some type of distress is, I mean, look, there were kids who were like, you know, mean to my kid in school, and I still hate them, you know, like so, let alone, you know, any kind of physical suffering. I can remember my younger son coming home, and he went to this sort of progressive hippie school, and they were letting them cut down tree branches, and he was using a handsaw, and he decided it would be a good idea. He was holding the branch, and he decided it would be a good idea to just sort of whack the branch with the saw. And so we cut like a little sort of divot, like a flap open in his thumb. And my wife was in Scotland visiting her family, and so it was all on me. And I was like, no, you know, I can't deal with this. So I had to take him to the hospital, and, you know, they did put a little stitch in and all this kind of stuff, and all things considered, it was fine. But I was amazed at how completely overwhelmed I felt by just that little injury to him. So I think that, you know, the people, there were so many people, our children, our parents, our friends. It's funny, Sophie mentioned self-care earlier, even ourselves, right, that we're supposed to caretake, we're supposed to. And when that doesn't work, or when that goes wrong, it feels like this profound crisis, I think, you know, this kind of profound, almost failing in some ways, even though, even though it's not necessarily, you know, but it's as if there's guilt just waiting to attach itself to you, which again, 12 years of Catholic school, that could be the explanation for that. But guilt, it's the gift that keeps on giving. But yeah, so I don't know. That's just a couple of things to throw out anyway.
Yeah, obviously, caring for family is a big part of where I end. So it's kind of the story is, you know, taking place in a family of women, grandmother, mother, and daughter who all live in this house on a very isolated island, and they are very isolated from their community. And so the story is about Elin, the daughter, who's 19, and her mother has always been bedbound her whole life and has never spoken or looked at Elin or, you know, really shown any sign of life, except sort of eating, or, you know, they feed her and they wash her and they, you know, move her so she doesn't get bed sores and infections, and they take care of her infections. And I suppose I was quite interested in this sort of idea of like caring for this person, this kind of presence in the house that like is sort of like in this passive way completely dominating. And so I was interested in that idea, and I was interested in the idea of like, you know, caring, especially I suppose for women, is seen as a very kind of like innate, instinctive, like we're supposed to nurture and you're supposed to be selfless about it. And, you know, it's actually a very complicated sort of situation to be in, the sort of the caregiver, and like the resentment that is kind of like a bit sort of unspoken or transgressive, like is there, like it's got to be there. And it's a big tradition in Irish literature, actually, the kind of the mother in the bed is a kind of trope that appears again and again in the, you know, particularly Irish theater and things like that. And and that was something I like looked at a lot when I was researching and kind of trying to sort of, I suppose, draw out some of the, you know, particulars of my story. And I suppose like the whole thing, you know, I was very interested in like, if you'd never really been looked at or spoken to by your mother, and your whole life had actually been like completely, you know, funneled into this very narrow existence of caring for her. And, you know, what kind of person does that produce? And, you know, it was a story that really like, you know, rose up because, you know, I was in a really similar situation in that, you know, my father got early onset Alzheimer's when he was in his 50s. He was really young, and he, you know, his decline was like sort of gradual, then total. You know, it was unbelievable. And I think they kind of say that with early onset Alzheimer's, it can happen so fast, and you can have this terrible kind of paradox where the person's physically young and well and strong in so many ways, but like, you know, their mind is like completely eroded. And so like the last years of my dad's life, the last 3 years, he was kind of in a like vegetative state, and like we didn't really care for him at home because it became impossible. And so, you know, he lived in a hospice or a care home, and you know, obviously just I spent a lot of hours at his bedside, and like, you know, a lot of those hours of kind of tapping out the illness of someone you love is you're kind of struck by the banality in so many ways. Like there's only so much you can really try and make it special, because ultimately it's fucking devastating and it's boring and it's hard to watch. And ultimately you go on your phone and you, I don't know, like I did all kinds of things at his bedside. You know, like I used to rub his head, how to connect him, how to reach him. And I used to think to him, but then more often than not, I'd scroll Instagram. And, you know, sometimes I'd have a baby with me. I'd be feeding my baby, gossiping with my mother, you know, all the stuff. So I wasn't like, I wasn't there carrying out the, like the real intense kind of labor of caring for him. But I was very struck by like just how it completely like chases away so much of your love and your kind of bond and your affection gets really like corrupted by the illness. And I then like, that was when the kind of character of Elin came to me as this kind of, what does this situation produce in a person if it's all you've ever known of your parent, you know? And so that kind of caring thing is just like so central to where I end. And I suppose the thing with Elin and where I end, like the big kind of catalyst for the story is that a young mother comes to the island and she's an artist and she has a really small baby, and Elin like has never really seen mothering. Like, I think it's the first time that she really starts to like conceive of the deprivation that she has, you know, endured and lived in. And and then obviously it's, well, it is what it is. It goes great. Everyone's very happy in the end. Because obviously, you see, there's such a kind of, I think, such a kind of a terror in the kind of responsibility that a carer has, you know. Like, I even remember when I first became a mother, I felt just such, like, I felt this, like, tsunami of terror about my own sudden, awful power. That, you know, I could destroy this child, this baby, you know, and like that scared me. That was like, I don't know, it just kind of consumed the whole first year of being a mother. I just was just kind of awed and terrified by the way that you are like this child's complete universe. And like, it was just so, you know, I was very kind of interested in that kind of like terrible sort of sense that the person is like at the mercy of whoever is taking care of them and or them. And yeah, like I was very interested in like misery, you know. I went back and reread Misery and you know, lots of there's an Alice Sebold novel called Almost Moon that should be considered horror. And it's kind of similar to my situation in that it's a child and their parent is kind of losing it, and you know, that goes dark as well. But I do remember a lot of people reading Where I End and kind of texting me and being like, oh my god, I feel so sorry for Elin. And I'd be like, what page are you on? But I did want people to feel sorry for her because she is tragic, you know. And obviously to stay with her and root for the character, we have all those kind of things that we have to address as writers in terms of like, how will we make sure people want to be with her for this whole story, even if she starts to behave in ways that are vile.
It's so interesting that you brought up Alice Sebold, right? Because she recently was discovered that she had wrongly accused the man who didn't rape her. So she'd, you know, written a best-selling book called Lucky about, you know, having been raped and survived, and, you know, her her abuser going, her rapist going to jail. And then it was discovered that no, he was not her rapist, and that he had been just sort of dragged through the justice system as a black man in the US. And so her act of care and healing for herself destroyed this other person's life. And, you know, and he said this interesting thing, like, well, we're totally like tied to each other now forever. And then there was sort of an update on her, and she was just like shattered. She's like, I don't want to write anymore. I can't even really speak because I'm afraid of what my words will do. It's really terrifying, you know, these kinds of responsibilities to ourselves, to take care of ourselves, to take care of others. I think.
Yeah, because he served, what, about 20 years?
It's like 20 years, yeah. And
unreal.
I mean, obviously, you know, the justice
system. And then the actual rapists only get a few months.
Right. And right. So the justice system is more to blame
for anything that happened
there than, you know, anything Alex Siebold or this man did. You know, it's always more guilty than the people that it even contends with. But I think that, you know, for me, you know, in Hawk Mountain, without giving anything away for people who haven't read it, it's like, there's a body in the book, and there's you know, a father and a son and a friend as well. So Andrea Lawler said the book was parenting horror, which I thought was a good term. But the one
I thought it was like a really amazing kind of thesis on how men can multitask.
Yeah. Well, you'll never know my writing process. But I but I did think, like, for me, the idea of caretaking in this book, some of it has to do with how we can't relate to people until they're dead or until they're harmed or whatever. And so there's something central to the novel about that. But then also just to say, like, there's a moment where the father, Todd, takes his son, Anthony, to this place that has taxidermied animals. And he reaches out and touches this taxidermied fox. And he's kind of afraid to. And his dad is like, no, you can touch it now that it's dead. You can have this kind of intimacy with it that you could never have with it when it was alive. And so in some ways, mm-hmm. there's also this. And I now, as you're talking, Sophie, I'm thinking about, you know, when my mom died of cancer, I was 23, and she's just, you know, slowly, well, it was like very slow and then very fast, like as you describe the Alzheimer's, where she was like deteriorating over, you know, years and then just months. And as the deterioration happened over months, and she couldn't really walk, she was in and out of consciousness, all this, she was in hospice care in our home. So I'd come home from college and I would bathe her, and I would, you know, change. She was wearing a diaper. I would change her diaper. I would do, and all this like had brought this kind of intimacy to my mother and I that I never had ever had before, and never would have been able to have had she not been dying. I think probably if I were the sole caretaker, I would have been bored too. I mean, there weren't cell phones then, so I couldn't scroll, but I did sit in the room and read a book, you know, while she was just kind of out of it or whatever. But I also think that in these experiences of caretaking, the horribleness also can bring this kind of love or this kind of intimacy that actually isn't available in the everyday life, which I suppose is what, you know, hospice workers know, you know, really well. And certain other people, death doulas and those kinds of people might know a bit more.
It's so interesting, like the way as well, death kind of comes on, like, and it's like before the actual like breathing stops, the death is like kind of taking hold of it. It's how I kind of remember kind of experiencing it. Like, I don't know where you guys were with your parents, but like, I spent the last kind of, you know, 20 hours in the room with my dad.
Yeah.
And like, I remember certain things, like some, like he already felt quite like hard, like I could knock on his chest. It was kind of almost like, you know, like he'd already kind of like his body was kind of forming its own tomb. And like, I remember there was this kind of plug-in, like big mechanical air freshener that was just there, kind of like kind of grinding away in the room with us. And there was just this kind of, you know, I suppose this kind of like death level, like vampire level, spirit level, death level, that was just for like inhabiting. And then I remember kind of feeling this kind of thing of like, God, it's so weird the way death kind of creeps. You kind of think that it's sort of a dead stop, but that actually it's creeping. And then when he actually, and you know, when at the very end you're watching for the breaths and the kind of like length between them can get very long, and you have quite a few kind of jump scares of like, it's happened, you know, and it's like, you know, it seizes you for a minute and then you realize it's okay. They're still breathing and there's still time to whisper in their ears and there's still time. And then I just remember the very last, you know, breath when he really was dead, this instant emptiness of the body.
Yeah.
Did you ever notice this? Like just this complete, I was just like, whoa, he was there and he's gone. What? Like, just like, I hadn't even looked away. It was like it happened right before my eyes, just this instant emptiness.
In fact, I think I had a blend of the experience you're talking about and the one that John brought up before, where my mother was dying in the family house, or the house that she and my stepfather lived in. And I was in my bedroom, which was right above the room where she was in hospice. And just before, like a few moments before she died, she appeared to me fully recomposed by the bed, and she whispered something to me, or I whispered something to her, actually, in this like weird kind of backwards way of talking that so often accompanies the dead. And then she went away, and my stepfather called me downstairs, and I watched her die in that moment. Just to say one thing about John, what you said before, that moment, which is what people call it, crisis apparition, it's so common that people see their loved ones before they die or just around the time of their death, that like it's almost like seems anti Occam's razor to not say that the dead are reaching out to us. This would be such a common experience for so many people. And then I went downstairs and she was still kind of breathing. And then she had this sound that was like the death rattle of, you know, that people talk about, where you could hear, it was this sound like a door creaking shut came out of her, and then tears came out of her eyes, and then she died. So I'd experienced her fullness and her contact with me. And then I had experienced the vacating, as you said, and was like, okay, this is done. So, I think it's, and you know, it was a really beautiful moment, you know, to be there with her when she died too. I just thought, my goodness, like you were there when I was born and I'm here when you're dying. Like what a wonderful, what a wonderful experience. I think something that I had thought about before, you know, when I was thinking about you guys both being on the show was, and I was thinking about this mainly in relation to your novel, The Fisherman, John, was because in that book, there are a few people that are grieving events that are kind of interlinked over different time periods. And everybody's grieving in a different way, and they take different actions out of their grieving. And I was just thinking now from this conversation, like, one of the really hard things to deal with in life is that everybody grieves differently. And every death brings with it a different kind of grieving process. And sometimes people's actions become completely unintelligible to us. I had a really close friend die and I was like, okay, you know, like I was fine. And I wasn't fine. I actually was going through a lot inside, but I could deal with it. And so people were like, aren't you sad? I'm like, yeah, I'm sad, you know, but it was a different kind of... whereas I've seen people just totally shut down, you know, I've seen people be broken for, you know, a decade, you know, over a death where I'm like, well, like, don't you understand this happens to all of us? So I think it's not just the death that's frightening to us, but seeing how different people respond to death and the complete otherness in that happens, the othering where we really can't connect to someone else's grieving process. It seems almost absurd to us sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think two things. I think, you know, Peter Straub died last year And he was a big hero of mine growing up, and I knew him a little bit. I had lunch with him a couple of times. I would see him at ReaderCon most years. And his death just absolutely gutted me. There were lots of people, lots of writers, you know, who spent much more time with him and who were much, I guess you would say, closer to him. But, you know, I still mourn that loss more than just because, oh, I'm not going to get to read his next novel, but I mourn his loss personally. And then I think to myself that the night that my father died, my brother and I were living in Albany. It's a long story. Anyway, I had to drive up to get my brother and such. And it was very, very late at night. My younger sister and I drove up, and I parked my car, and I parked it illegally. But I was like, it's 2 a.m. Who's going to know? And I came out of our apartment, and there was a cop there just very delicately placing a ticket on my windshield. And I just lost it. I just started screaming at him. And, you know, and I'm screaming, my father is dead. And what are you doing? And, you know, and he was completely, I'm sure he thought I was having, you know, a psychotic break or some kind of drug trip or something like that. And fortunately my siblings ran out and were like, it's okay. It's okay. It's okay. Relax, relax, relax. But I have never done anything like that. These days, especially, but I mean, back then, you know, I would never have thought I would do something like that. Even being annoyed that the guy put a ticket on my car. So what? It's, you know, it's going to be $20. It'll be fine. But I just, yeah, I accessed other parts of my personality, I suppose. And I certainly think that for me, I think for me, after my dad died, I was utterly convinced that it was not set in stone yet. I was utterly convinced that there was some way, if I could just figure it out, that I could kind of, like, you know, make a certain moves, turn right here, turn left there, and I would be back before he died, and I could stop it, or I could prevent it from setting, as it were. And he had been ill for 2 months and very ill. Probably brain dead for a number of days at the point he died, although we didn't, it was only in retrospect that we realized that. And I think that, you know, what I was thinking about is that so much of death, so many of the rituals that surround dying, I guess, the actual moment of dying, death, you know, the funeral, all this kind of stuff, there is a certain comfort in, okay, well, we've got to do this. You get on the phone and call, get the phone book out and call everybody and let them know, okay, what funeral home are we going to use? Like, all of that stuff is actually, it helps you get through that unimaginable period. But the difficult thing, especially these days, I think, where people are, I don't know, they're taking longer and longer to die. I don't know a better way to put it, but they're living with in that state of approaching death. They're approaching it for longer and longer periods. Is we don't have rituals for how to deal with that. And so, yeah, you know, you bring a book or you bring your phone, and then you feel guilty for being on it. But it's like, but what else are you supposed to do? You know, it's
well, to that point, and maybe just to sort of wrap things up here, not that I really even want to, I could talk with you guys for hours more, and I hope I get a chance to, but I was thinking it is something I talked about with Sarah Grant and Nathan Ballengrud on an earlier episode about horror in this series, where this idea of, if I turn the right way, if I, you know, sort of make the right move, somehow I can shift out of this reality of forms and laws and actually do something else. And that is the consciousness of the horror writer, which is, I don't think, something people give us much credit for or as much as we deserve, which is, it's actually a tremendous exercise in freedom. That to write stories about defying the laws of the lawfulness of the world, and finding the pockets of existence that don't obey the things that we know to be true, or that have to be true, or that have to exist. That in fact, horror really is a genre, if it is a genre at all, a genre of freedom in a lot of ways. Mm. Freedom that comes with responsibility, restriction, limitation, terror to it, all those sorts of things. But it's a navigation of a refusal in a lot of ways of what we're told must be. And I think that's something that's come up again and again on this episode. And I'm so excited to have talked with you both about it and to have read about that in your works, John Langan and Sophie White. Thank you so much for having this conversation with me.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you so much, everybody, for listening. Bye now.